Good afternoon. I'm Callie Crossley. This is the Callie Crossley Show. Today, we're looking at local treasures and traditions. We're now turning our attention to the art of the hack. That's prank to you and me, which MIT students have mastered. A current exhibit at the MIT Museum showcases some of these hijinks. Joining me to talk about it is Jay Kaiser, Special Assistant to the Chancellor and Professor Emeritus at MIT, where he was the head of the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy. His new book, Mens et Mania, The MIT Nobody Knows, will be out on May 1st. Jay Kaiser, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, so we got to talk just briefly about the history of hacking at MIT. Since I might as well tell listeners now, all the people in it are anonymous. Who knows how it got started or when it got started? How do you document that?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, there are the boundaries between the hackers and the people who are sort of supposed to keep an eye on the hackers are blurred. But for example, I was giving a talk once in Chicago, and I was describing a hack which I really liked. It's a hack which, when you walk into Lobby 7, there is one of these august sayings that are engraved in around the rotunda there. Mm-hmm. You know, an institute dedicated to art, the industrial sciences, etc. And one year, the hackers replaced it with dedicated to science in the industrial arts and hacking. They did it with a board that was colored just like the original, and they carved the letters hacking just the way the original was done, and they placed them there with spring-loaded pressure clamps in order to keep them in place. It was so good that it went for 2 days before anybody even noticed. And when I was telling this after the talk, there was a crowd of people came up to me and they were asking me about this and that. And one young woman came to the front and she said, "If you think it's easy carving those letters into styrofoam, you should think twice."
And then she disappeared.
And then she disappeared. So that's how it is. And there was another hack. For example, there was a – I mean, these are hacks. I don't even think it's – MIT's just published this updated version called Nightworks, which is a great history of hacks if you want – if you're at all interested in it. It gives you from beginning to end. But this is one that I didn't see in their book. Hmm. There was an elevator in the student center, okay? And what you do is you press a button and the elevator would go to another floor. Well, one day, I believe, I'm not sure when it was, it may have been April Fool, you pressed a button and all of a sudden the elevator would start talking to you and would sort of say something like this. You'd press the button and the elevator would say, "Basement, student center basement. Basement? Basement? Who knew we had a basement?"
I love this.
Well, the wiring for that and all of the sensors for that suddenly showed up outside my door.
Oh, you're kidding.
That's right. It was dismantled. And of course, in true hack fashion, do no harm. It's like the Hippocratic Oath.
Right.
You know, the first thing a physician must swear to do is no harm. Well, that's how hackers are. And I mean, real hackers, the true hackers. And they had simply put this elaborate electrical system on top of the elevator so that the sensors would work at every floor trigger a recording. And when it was all done, all you had to do was take it out.
My guest is Jay Kaiser. We're talking about the history of hacking, pranksterism at MIT, a long tradition. Now, the point of the tradition of hacking at MIT is to really showcase the engineering skill. I mean, because these things are very elaborate, as you've just described. And that's it. It seems to me they do that beautifully. Hacks do that beautifully.
I actually think that that's just one of the points. And in fact, I don't think it's the main point.
Ah.
You know,
what's the main point then?
Freud once said that sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Yes.
Well, a hack is not – sometimes a prank is just a prank, but not at MIT. My view of hacks at MIT is that actually it's a coping mechanism. Hmm. And you'll notice that one of the first compendium of hacks was called the Institute – the Journal of Institute Hacks, Tomfoolery, and Pranks. Embedded in that title are the initials IHTFP. And those are very important because what they stand for and what every MIT student and faculty and administrator knows is it stands for I hate this, use your imagination, with the letter F, place. So I hate this bleeping place. Okay. When I was associate provost, people would come up to me, faculty, and say, well, look, if they hate this bleeping place, why do they stay here? And the answer is, of course, that they don't hate it. Well, if they don't hate it, why do they say they hate it? And, of course, that's a very good question. And here's the nub of it. MIT is a very special institution. It's an institution which is dominated by science and engineering. Unlike a liberal arts school of the kind that I went to, and like Wellesley, the one that you went to, mm-hmm. there are lots of places to hide. I mean, for example, you can take a course in romantic poetry and somebody can ask you what's the meaning of Ode to a Grecian Urn, and, you know, there's no right answer. There's many answers, and some of them are interesting and less and more interesting. But that's not the case at MIT. There's no right, there's no ambiguity. There's only one right answer. And what happens is that when a kid comes to MIT, he's in the top 5% of the class, and very soon that kid is going to find out he's in the top half, the bottom half of the class.
Because everybody else is in the top 5% of their class, too.
We once did a study, 70, and it turned out that we asked the incoming class, what percentage of you think you're going to end up in the top half of the class? 75% said they did. Okay, so what happens at MIT is that very quickly you find out how good you are. And that's a very, very hard pill to swallow. I mean, to be able to face yourself and say, you know, I'm not as good as I thought I was. That's really hard. And so you have to deal with that. Now, how do you deal with that?
In a positive way.
Mm-hmm. What I think is so great about MIT's hacking tradition is that it's really a psychiatric, a self-therapy, which is incredibly creative, but it's also incredibly useful.
I agree with that.
The way it works is it's like putting on sunglasses on a very bright day.
Well, these young men and women are putting on some great sunglasses because I love all the pranks that they do. Many of us who've lived here in the area for a while look forward to them every year. I want to know how you join if it's secret. Does somebody tap you? I mean, how?
it doesn't work like that. You just students talk to one another. And you kind of filter out. There's more than one hacking group.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And you may end up in one or another. The students let it known that they're sort of interested in that sort of thing because when they first come to MIT, they arrange to investigate all of the tunnels under the institute. And people who are interested in that kind of thing are prime candidates. And you gravitate toward one another. Anonymity is very important.
I see that.
In fact, the three things that define a hack are, first of all, it has to be engineeringly sophisticated, as you pointed out. And also, as you pointed out, it's got to be anonymous and it's got to be benign. That is to say, it can't do any harm. But the true hack makes fun of MIT and therefore pulls the chair out from under it. And it says, okay, so you judge me to be a C student, but look.
Here's what
I can do to you. And I'm not just putting panties over the founder's head. What I'm going to do is make an elevator talk or put a police car on the dome.
Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
A couple rivalries that have involved MIT hacks. The Harvard-Yale game is a favorite place for hacks to take place.
Yeah.
And then I didn't know that there was a rivalry with Caltech, that Caltech has somewhat of a tradition as well.
Yeah, that's gone back a very long time because really Caltech is really the MIT of the West. It's a much smaller school. I think its student body is something like 600. Whereas, or maybe a little more, but at MIT we have something like 4,000 undergraduates. But there is a rivalry between them. But you notice, as soon as you do rivalry, you're not talking hacks.
So,
you know, for example, the Harvard-Yale game where the balloon blew up.
Right.
By the way, that was the second attempt at it. There was an earlier attempt in 1962 that failed. And I once met the guys
Can you describe that for people so they know what we're talking about?
Which one? The failed
the balloon on the the game.
I think it was in the second quarter. Harvard was playing Yale, and all of a sudden this very large weather balloon began to grow out of the ground like a huge flower. And it had written on it, MIT. And people were just stunned by this. I happened to live next door to a guy who was sitting three rows back from the president of Harvard at the time. And I am happy to say that he was livid.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, he was really angry. I admit that that's hearsay. And if we were in court, somebody would say, I object, Your Honor.
Now, because it's anonymous, but there's only a few names that have come out of people who have, or alum of hacker groups. And, I could say I was because nobody would know, really,
right,
unless somebody would out me. And then they have to be
right,
not anonymous, too.
Right.
Are there some names that we should know who are former hackers?
None that I would. I know some, but I wouldn't. And I don't want to be coy about this.
Yeah.
I know two people. One who is the guy who told me that he, in fact, was the one who gave me the wires. By the way, I still have those wires at home, and I'm leaving them in my will to MIT Museum.
Oh, that's great.
And the other guy actually sent me a bunch of emails about 5 or 6 years ago after he read my article on hacks, and we had a conversation. But they declare themselves to you. And even if they do, I've never blown their cover.
Okay. So it's sort of like Alcoholics Anonymous,
exactly,
on the other end of the spectrum.
I once wanted to do a hack myself.
Yeah, I hear that. That was my question. Yeah. I hear that you wanted to, and they said no.
My boss said if I did, he'd break my leg.
Well, how would he know? It's anonymous. Who's going to out you? I mean, really? I wouldn't tell.
I should have thought of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Too bad I didn't know you then.
I think that when we think about MIT culture, which your new book, Men's Mania, the MIT Nobody Knows, is going to explore, this just seems so much a part of it. Are we right to think of this very sophisticated hacking as a part of the MIT culture, or is it just something a few kids like to do?
It's very much a part. It's very much a part. And a few kids do it, but it's sort of like they're the spokesman for everybody. And the whole community loves it. The administration is always antsy about it because there's always the possibility of liability. And it's really it's kind of like a dance of intimacy.
Even at this point, they're still nervous about it.
Well, look, somebody falls through a roof. They're up there trying to do something.
Well, that's a good point.
And so the university – and in fact, there was a case in which a young woman was on the roof of, I think, a building on East Campus, and she actually fell into a coal chute. She must have fallen three, four stores. But fortunately, there was a pile of coal dust at the bottom, and so she was not killed. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of thing that worries people. And the hackers take that very seriously.
Okay.
That's why it has to be benign. And if you read like Nightworks, you'll see that there's a list of things that hackers do. Don't climb walls unless you if you don't know what you're doing, ask somebody who knows how to do it. And they have long lists of protocols, and they take themselves very seriously.
Well, they do, but I in this section that says Why We Hack, of course, written by Anonymous, it says, many of us hack first and foremost because it's fun. It's fun to scale tall buildings and plant unusual objects there. It's fun to do difficult things and do them well. It's fun to make people smile, and it's fun to make them scratch their heads in wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that says it all.
No, I don't think it does.
Well, I like that. Well, so, I can respond to that.
I know, but it's like you go to a psychiatrist and you're getting a divorce and you say to the psychiatrist, I'm not angry at my wife. I'm really not angry. Yeah, sure, you're not angry.
Okay.
Well, okay, so they say it's fun, and I'm sure it is fun.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is the motivation for this whole thing is essentially not to inflict pain, but to cope with pain inflicted. That's why they're benign, you see.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, it's a very serious, I think, a very serious basis. I say more power to them for having been able to come up with that coping mechanism. MIT is tough.
No kidding.
Yeah.
MIT is very tough. Now, I got to ask, why the name hack as opposed to prank?
Yeah. Well, hack, I don't know. You should have asked your previous guest that.
Maybe I'll ask him. That'll be his next book.
Yeah, that'll be a good idea. If you look in Nightworks, it talks about the history of the word.
Oh, okay.
And the and what they actually point out is that the term hack in its sense at MIT, which means a prank, mm-hmm. is really only about, 30 years old.
Oh.
Prior to that, hacking meant working on a computer, trying to
hacking into, that's the way I know it.
Well,
yeah.
It was even benign originally. Its original term was when you were hacked a computer, what you were doing was you were trying to resolve a problem. And then you, took on this business of hacking into a system. It took on a negative thing, mm-hmm. and now the two things are actually opposed to one another because the MIT hack prank does not have the evil import of hacking into a system.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how language is. I mean, these words pop up and they're used, and which one is going to bob to the surface? Which meaning will bob to the surface and last? You just don't know. Society will decide that for you.
You mentioned that MIT has this sort of, you know, delicate dance because of, you know, liability questions and other things. You don't want kids putting themselves in harm's way to try to make these things happen, and even though they may be fun for them. So sometimes the hacks have had a place in the MIT museum, and sometimes not. I understand that they were pulled out of the museum at some point, and a couple times, and then they're back. And
yeah.
Precipitated their being taken out, and what brought them back?
I'm not sure. I don't know what caused that. It might have been this intent to downplay the hacks, to try to change the hacking culture, but you can't do that. It just won't happen. It's just too deeply embedded. I know that now the hacks, if you go around MIT, you'll see hacks on the walls. You'll see photographs of them. Above the cafe in the Stata Center is a cow that came from Frank Giuffrida's steakhouse.
Yes.
And that was a cow that was hauled up onto the dome. I have ridden that cow.
Hopefully not while it was up on the dome.
No. It was in the Compton Gallery at MIT at the time, but I got astride it, and I may be the only person who's ever ridden that cow. But now the MIT is not hiding it, but they're walking a fine line, you know, and, in trying to make sure that nobody gets hurt.
Right, because I suppose from the university's perspective, actually, if you were to praise it too much, and you got to praise this engineering skill, then, you know, kids are trying to top themselves next go around.
Here's a perfect problem. How do you get to the top? How do you get onto the dome?
I have no idea.
There's a door, and the kids are expert lock pickers. Okay, so what you do is you make it anti-lock proof. So you think that's going to stop the kids from getting on the dome? No, they'll go outside. And they'll do it outside where it's more dangerous. And so you just don't, you know, that's the kind of judgment you constantly have to make.
Oh, so are there other schools other than Caltech that have tried to enter into the hack culture for whom MIT is a model?
I don't think so. But that's because the notion of hacking comes right out of the culture of MIT, which is a tough place. And you need to cope with it. You have to be able to find a way to have dignity in a place that's going to tell you you're not as smart as you thought you were. You see, here's the problem. Let me tell you, I don't think it's the problem, but here's the character of the culture. In most universities, when a student goes there, takes a course in sociology or anthropology or whatever, and the faculty member says make some claim about, the structure of American society, the student can say, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, you're crazy. It's not that way at all. And okay, if the student can prove it, fine, but the student is not forced to take the faculty's judgment. But at MIT, these guys who teach these courses are world class. And when the students come, they want to be like the faculty. And so whether they like it or not, they want to be able to do what the faculty does. And the faculty, for its part, wants to clone itself. And so what happens is that you have a student body that has bought hook, line, and sinker the values of the place. They have internalized it. They want those values. That's why they self-selected to come to MIT. And now when the place judges you, where are you going to hide? When the judge says, look, you may have been born and bred in Kentucky, but you're just a crumb up here. I mean, there's no place to hide. And so there's just various ways you deal with that. And I have great admiration for hacking precisely because it's a form of public therapy.
It's like releasing the steam off a pressure cooker a little bit.
Yep, exactly.
Again, because it's anonymous and we don't know who they are, but in your travels and talking with people, are there commonalities among the people who choose to hack? Because everybody at MIT is not hacking. So lots of people are, but many are not. What would you say would be the commonalities? We've established that lots of people are trying to release this pressure, but what else?
Well, that's a very good question. I think I know what it is, but I really can't – I haven't done a study of it. But these are people who are more willing than others to be disobedient.
Okay.
psychiatrists have a term for it. They call it disobedient dependency. Anybody listening to us now who has a teenage child knows what disobedient dependency is. The dependency, the child feels very dependent on the parent, but the child hates that it feels dependent on the parent. So what does the child do? It's disobedient. Okay, so the personality trait would be people who are more willing than others to be disobedient in the face of authority.
And you know what? That's where the people come from who come up with the new ideas about everything I need in my life. So, sorry, parents, I'm okay with that in this setting.
So am I.
Okay. What a great conversation. I love it. There's a new book. It's called Night Work, A History of Hacks and Pranks at MIT. But my guest has been Jay Kaiser, and we've been talking about the history of hacks at MIT, which dates back almost as far as the venerable institution itself. And Jay Kaiser was special assistant to the chancellor and is now professor emeritus at MIT, where he was the head of the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy. His new book is Mens et Mania, The MIT Nobody Knows, and it'll be out on May 1st. I think it's going to be some good reading. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly.
We'll be back after this break, but first, hear how you can support the programming that WGBH brings you every day, from the world to jazz on WGBH with Eric Jackson. You're listening to listener-supported radio. We'll be back after this break. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for WGBH comes from you and from Boston Private Bank and Trust Company. Boston Private Bank provides private and commercial banking and investment management and trust services to individuals and businesses. You can learn more by visiting bostonprivatebank.com. And from Arts Emerson, The World on Stage, presenting director Peter Brook in Boston for the first time in 40 years with Samuel Beckett's Fragments along with The Grand Inquisitor, March 23rd to April 3rd. Information at artsemerson.org.
WGBH.org/Callie Crossley. Follow us on Twitter or become a fan of The Callie Crossley Show on Facebook. Today's show was engineered by Alan Mattis and produced by Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, and Abby Ruzica. We're a production of WGBH Radio, Boston's NPR station for news and culture.